The Catskill landscape has a quality of its own. Drive down any of its back roads, and you will taste the unique flavor of this country. If you travel, for instance, through the gulch at the upper end of Watson Hollow, high on the shoulder of Peekamoose, you will enter a narrow pass with steep walls on either side, at first glance complete wilderness. High waterfalls zigzag down the rocky ledges, and the treetops stand out against the sky. But a closer look reveals evidences of man's life in these quiet woods. The sagging masonry of an old dam, woods roads leading upward where no wagon wheels have rolled for three generations. The pass widens out to open fields, a stone house, a weathered barn. And this is the special quality of the Catskills, everywhere wilderness, blended with the works of man. Man's signature is written on the land. It is inscribed in the stone fences that still enclose the fields down below Samsonville, in the tumbled tannery vats speckled by sunlight. The story is all around us, but few can read. Only the older people can decipher the symbols. And the time is coming when those who remember will be dead and forgotten. And when they are gone, the hills will have lost their human history, and we will raise a generation of strangers in their own land. In the older folks, we have a bridge that reaches far back into the cloudy past. The memory of man is a wonderful instrument, a mirror that reflects the forms and faces of generations long departed. Here is a man who has lived for over a century. When he was a baby, Lincoln was a backwoods lawyer. Railroads were new and the West untamed.
My name is Ezra Griffin, if you can spell it. And I was born 1858, July the 13th.
Where were you born?
It was called then Smithville. It's now called Big Indian.
Big Indian?
Yeah, between Big Indian and Pine Hill in a log cabin. Mm-hmm. So my folks said that. I don't know. I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I don't remember my birth, no.
What was the first thing that you can remember?
The settling of the Civil War.
How did you hear about that?
Well, it came through by a man on horseback. Came through the mountain, up through the mountain roads.
You said, the other time we were here, you said something about the first time that railroad came through there. You remember that?
Yes.
What was that like?
I don't know. I can't just explain it. It was a surprise. It was quite a sight to see a steam car come through there. We hadn't heard much of it before it got through. And the engine that they had on to draw the gravel and stuff and ties and rails, old Nancy, I think they called it. And she jumped back a little while and jumped back on again.
Squire Elwin Davis lives in a large farmhouse overlooking the Ashokan Reservoir. Sitting on his front porch, he can look down over the fields and into the water that covers the valley where he was born. He can tell you right where the village of West Shokan stood under that water. He knows the exact site of the old house built by his forebear, Henrik Crispell, who settled the valley in 1760. As Davis talks, the waters of the reservoir evaporate. The past returns, a tiny little glimpse of the past. A testy old Dutchman and his Negro slave, Jackie.
I have down home a bill of sale of the slave, dated 1795. A black man called Jack. and he was sold from father to son for the sum, a present sum, of about $150. This indenture is made out so that there'd be no possible doubt but what this man, once the deal had been made, but what he was literally sold as a slave. Black Jacket. Well, going back to the original part of it, he was sold from father to son. He was sold by one of the first white settlers down there in the upper reservoir region where I live. He was a Hollander named Jan Crispell, and he sold his slave to his son Thomas, who Thomas, incidentally, was a veteran of the Revolutionary War. About the time of the War of 1812, Jackie was getting fairly well along in years, and this Thomas Crispell's son, Abram, he and the old colored fellow didn't get along very good. And so he delivered an ultimatum to his father that they'd either have to part with one or the other. And so, in order to keep peace in the family, the old man, Abram Crispell, he gave old Jackie his freedom. And that went along fine. They helped him build a log cabin up along the stream now known as the Jackie Brook, a short distance south of where the present Olive Library is, formerly the West Shokan Schoolhouse. And as a boy, I can well remember the old orchard there, and I can still go to the place on the lower part of Mary Margaret McBride's farm and show where his log cabin was and where the chimney had toppled over.
The age of homespun was an age of muscle and sweat, age of the broadaxe, the bark spud, and the peavey, age of the strong back and the skillful hands. Men and women toiled from can to cant. At Samsonville, they said a man never saw the sunshine in the village. He left for the bark woods before daybreak and came back after sunset. The hemlock was plentiful when the pioneer came, and the first big industry in the Catskills was the tannery. They peeled a lot of bark for the tanneries, so Mike Todd, an old woodsman, told us. Men worked from 15 to 16 hours a day in the bark woods. From sun to sun was the rule. He said the men got covered from head to foot with the sticky hemlock sap. I see 'em just so sticky, you'd take off a pair of overalls and let 'em dry, and they'd stand up by themselves. It was the spring of the year, and another thing they had a lot of trouble with in the bark woods was the gnats, no-see-ums. They'd just kill you in the warm and cloudy weather. You'd dab your face with kerosene and tar. In the shanties, they'd use smoke, a houseful of smoke, to drive out the gnats. Then old Mike went on to say, contractors would hire a gang of men to peel the bark, and there was a fellow around Shandaken that had about a dozen working for him and living in a shanty. His name was Conrad. He didn't feed him good, and they had a lot of bad butter. It didn't smell too good, and it didn't taste too good. So they made it up that Judd Todd, he was one of the 12 sons, would ask the blessing at the dinner table. So he got up to the table, and he says, O Lord of love, look down from above and give us something better. We're crammed and jammed and daily damned with Conrad's stinking butter. In the early days, people were neighborly. It was necessary for people to unite or perish. They helped each other at seed time and at harvest. They peeled apples together, husked each other's corn, and together they raised the heavy beams of their barns. These beams were hewed out of logs and fitted together in huge frames which they called bents, and everybody had to pull together to get those heavy bents up in the air.
An old man by the name of Roswell Smith, who was gone many years ago, he used to tell the story about the raising of the old mill. The old mill was made of large timbers, heavy timbers. It was 36 feet long, the beams were, and hewed and squared up. So there was 18 to 24 inches square, some of them.
and it was very hard at the raising. He was telling me about the raising of the mill. Obadiah Sprague was the carpenter, and he always, at the raising, he always carried a square around on his shoulder and told the rest what to do. Well, they got the bent together, they put up in four bents. They got the back bent together, ready to raise. They got all the men that was handy, pulled up. They got it about breast high. And he would call her altogether, and they would try and get it about so high, and sag back. About breast as high as I did it. And it was discouraged to me, and he said, the first man that gave it, he says, I'll come down to this fire. He says, hang to it. The first man that digs, I'll cut down and get some props. Somebody back and got some props and got under. And so I got loose, but concerned, for he knew some of them let loose, it'd drop back and somebody. They got more men together, and they finally got the back raised that and the other
way. At the southern edge of the Catskills runs a long valley all the way from the Hudson River to the Delaware. It has always been the main route west from the days of the Indians. Down this valley for a major part of the last century ran the Delaware and Hudson Canal, populating a dozen villages and towns and bringing coal from the fields of Pennsylvania from the eastern cities. The names on the map are reminders of almost forgotten waterway, Phillipsport, Port Benton, Port Jackson, Creek Locks. For miles and miles, it is still possible to the route of the canal and firm the towpath, there's house, the masonry of the lock, which now enclose green and water, and too often
refuse dump.
At Eddyville, near there is a very well-preserved lock nearby. An old canal. Canaling held a fascination for the people of the surrounding farmland. Men and boys, the blast of the boatman's horn in the spring. The boat approached
as the first
was a call to adventure and travel. To Henry Mertens, the canal was a means of escape from a tyrannical mother. Henry's father died when he was a little boy, and his mother was a harsh taskmaster at Woods Farm in the hamlet of Mombacus.
How did you run away?
Well, to say that, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well,
is that new? Just
to me, you cut the weeds.
The weeds around. So I said, all right. Well, he said,
Get out of here. Well, I Said I'm going to get here. I should be stupid better to myself. You're better running up than putting it on.
I stayed away from that.